Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Hello everyone, it's Jesse Green here. Welcome back to SavvyDentist.com and to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. It is terrific to have you company for another episode of the show. One of the really great things about being a podcast is having the opportunity to talk to really interesting and fascinating people. And my guest today certainly fits into that category and then some. He is remarkable and extraordinary. Brett Connellan was surfing one afternoon after work in 2016 when his life changed in an instant. Prior to that, he had his hopes set on becoming a professional surfer and touring the world doing what he loves most. But that all got taken away one afternoon as he went for an after-work surf in the evening of March 30, 2016. He got knocked off his board, and the shark that knocked him off his board then came around to attack him, taking three quarters of the quadricep off his leg. This story, though, is not about sadness or tragedy. It's about one of overcoming. It's about one of resilience. And it's about understanding it's not what happens to you, but how you recover from it. And this story of Brett's is one of incredible resilience as he went on a journey of not just mental recovery, but physical recovery, and understanding that the power of a support team and the words of encouragement that matter most when you need them. And in this instance, those words of encouragement came from his physiotherapist, Scott. And when you hear Brett talk about the impact that Scott's had on his life and the words of encouragement he sent him, I tell you, it will touch your heart. It'll make you reflect. It'll make you think. And in my case, it brought a tear to my eye. The words were just so profound. And so in this podcast, listen carefully because there are so many life lessons in here. You know, life is always going to be a bit of a tricky encounter. None of us get out of life without dealing with setbacks and hurts and disappointments. But it's how we deal with those setbacks and hurts and disappointments that really mean the difference between having a mediocre life and having a great life. And I think by any measure, Brett is having a remarkable life. He's a remarkable guy with a remarkable message, helping so many people. His story has been featured on Stan. There's a documentary called Attacking Life. If you want to go and check that out, I'd really encourage you to do it. And of course, he's been featured in the media a whole bunch. So go and check out the ABC and other sites as well where you can hear or read about his story. But this is a really interesting podcast. Please do listen carefully. This is not a seven hacks or seven simple steps to do XYZ. This is a rich tapestry, a rich story, but it is jam-packed with life lessons to help you overcome anything that you may have encountered in your life or maybe will encounter in your life. It's unlikely many of us are ever going to be attacked by a shark, but I tell you, all of us will deal with setbacks, and this podcast is just something that I promise you over-delivers in every possible way. Brett is a fantastic guest, and without any further ado, here he is to share his story with you. Hey, Brett, welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. You're officially ensconced in my favorite part of the world in Kiama. How's things in glorious southern New South Wales?
As glorious as always would be the best way to put that. It's, we were talking just before about how nice it is to live here, and I didn't want to say at the time, but the last couple of weeks have just been so nice.
Oh, man, you're killing me.
Yeah.
Mate, I want to talk to you a bit about your story and a bit about your life. Now, there'll be a bunch of people that know your background as a competitive surfer. And of course, you know, Kiama, one of the beautiful things about Kiama is the beautiful beaches. It's well known for the blowhole, but Bombo Beach and all the other beaches in and around Kiama are spectacular. I wanted to ask you a little bit about what happened in 2016, if we can, just to set the scene about what you're doing and the story of what happened on that particular day in March.
Feels like it wasn't that long ago when in fact 2016 is quite a long time ago when you look at it like that. For me, that's a separate life though when I look back at it, which is I guess part of the reflection and why it feels like such a long time ago. Now at that point in 2016, I was on a bit of a pilgrimage to try and live out this dream I'd had for a very, very, very long time, which was to become a professional surfer. I had surfed my entire life, grew up, all of that. As you mentioned, everyone kind of knows the backstory of this up and coming surfer. Mm. What a lot of people don't know is that 2016, landing right in the start of that year was the year that I was going to give it my all. I'd actually planned that that was the year that I was going to put all my resources, my time and my effort into trying to live out that dream, trying to qualify for the world tour. So I had a lot of events lined up. I had a lot planned, and that all comes to a screeching halt on the 30th of March. So a little bit into the year as we're kind of starting to get up to the start of the competitive season, when I decide to go for a surf out Bombo, my local beach, one afternoon after work, just as an afternoon wash off, really, just to kind of clear my head of the day that I'd had. And that's kind of one of those decisions that you make where at the time it's just a regular decision that you make.
Mm-hmm.
Looking back in hindsight, it's a massive fork in the road moment, because after that, obviously the moment that does change my life forever, which is the moment I get attacked by a shark whilst I'm sitting out there trying to enjoy a surf. And this is, for me, obviously for a lot of different reasons, a very pivotal moment.
Mm.
I always look at the attack as being this incredibly quick and brutal and raw event, but also something that's very slow and has a lot of details and a lot of nuance to it. And I think looking at it from both sides is an important way to do it, because yeah, the brutal and quick and raw part of it is just experiencing it in the moment where, you know, I get hit from the right side incredibly hard, thrown off my surfboard. I look around before I can even figure out what has happened. I look down and see a shark biting my leg. And the immense power that this creature has in that moment to be grabbing onto my leg. And in that moment, it's kind of like your worst fears really just happening. And there's something about this moment where the impact of that is really just the enormity of the situation really hitting you. Like, there's the impact from the shark itself, but yeah, the impact of the moment is almost the one that stands out a little bit more to me then and there. For me, the next like 15 seconds, it is incredibly quick, where I go through this waterfall of like freezing, seeing what's going on, trying to fight it, trying to punch it, doesn't work, freezing again. Flight is obviously the last part of that fight, flight or freeze response that I've got left, which results in me pulling away from the shark, separating a large chunk of my cord. Now, I can't feel anything in that moment. Like, this is one of those things where a lot of people ask, like, why did you pull away from it? Why did you do this? Why did you do that? And I always say, there's no conscious decisions that happen there.
Yeah.
It's just instinct. It all takes over. And that's, I think, part of the thing that makes it feel so quick. So that goes from pulling away from the shark, losing that chunk of leg, swimming towards the beach, having the thought of, is this shark going to come back a second time? Mm. Looking over my shoulder to see it approaching. Lucky enough to, you know, stick my hands out to try and stop it. And my right hand having better aim than my left, right hand landing on its nose, left hand taking a small detour through its mouth. I've got a couple, these are the cool scars on my hand, which you probably won't be able to see there, and then on my wrist.
Oh, wow.
And then having, again, just another instinctual reaction when the next wave approaches to try and push the shark away and hope the wave will push me in. And then from there, it's just a rescue effort. My friend Joel that I was surfing with that afternoon, paddling towards me, putting me on his board and taking me into the beach and kind of removing me from that situation. I know that makes it sound like it happens so quick, but that's really what it feels like. It's so frantic in the moment. But with some time to look back at it and some time to reflect on it, there's obviously some big moments that do stick out. Mm. Because as quick as it is, it's also, as I said at the start, simultaneously incredibly slow.
Yeah.
And part of this is due to the reaction of that fight, flight, or freeze, and the ability to, as your body slows things down as a bit of an information gathering exercise, you can take in all these really fine details. So whilst it doesn't seem like I had much time to look around or figure out what was going on, I have very vivid memories from a lot of things during the attack and what happened afterwards. And they can be things like the feel of the shark's skin, which you wouldn't think that you would have time to be like, oh, this feels specifically like, you know, sandpaper. It's really rough. It's things like the complete absence of sound. And this is something that really sticks out to me. Wow. Because
that's an unusual.
It is a very unusual thing, but it sticks out so much because I think your expectation being in the moment like that, you're expecting to, first of all, be screaming for some sort of help. You think, I don't know, for me, I think of being attacked by an animal, you think of like a lion or something like that. You hear some sort of roaring. Sharks don't make noise, so it's obvious that that's not going to make noise. But there's not even the sound of the water splashing around. It's just this complete silence while you're really fighting for your life in that moment. And I think that is, for me, the perfect juxtaposition of the chaos and then also the calm that goes on within that. And then, you know, the other things are like just the vivid memories of looking the shark in the eyes and having that realization of your worst nightmares coming to fruition, and the fact that you can't do anything about it, and the fact that there's no arguing with the shark. Like, this is just something that you are in the middle of right now, and there's not a whole lot you can do about it. Mm. So it is interesting to me to kind of put those two stories next to each other, that frantic event that I spoke about, but then also this really slow, methodical, visual thing that I can recount. And I think part of that comes from the fact that I was conscious the whole time. I could remember everything. And obviously the fact that I survive obviously helps with that memory.
Yes.
Yes. But I think the thing that really summarizes the slow part and I guess the impactful part over there would be the luck.
Okay.
The reason I say that is because you don't pick up on these bits of luck whilst they're happening, but it's almost just like each domino that's falling, it's happening in this really poetical way where I look back and go through those events one by one. And when you see the little bits of luck from the moment I was attacked, which is the most unlucky moment of my life.
Yes.
Every little thing after that that happens is incredibly lucky. And they're things like where the shark bit me. So missing my femoral artery by about 2 millimeters.
Oh, gosh.
And, you know, you're someone who's going to have some sort of knowledge of the human body and how it operates. But for those that don't, femoral artery, major blood supply to the leg.
Do not want to rupture that.
Exactly. So incredibly lucky there. I was lucky that my friend Joel was surfing with me that afternoon. Mm. Joel, for all of his life-saving qualities, is not my most reliable of friends. And what I mean by that is he's that friend that everyone's got someone like this where you tell them you're going to go do something and they either show up late or just don't show up. Yeah. Don't show up. Like, this is Joel. I was so lucky that he was out there. I was lucky that he paddled towards me.
Yeah.
That if for him, I've talked to him about it and it's an instinctual reaction. It's not something that he said, oh, there's something going on there, I need to go do that. He just said, something just took him. It was just that reaction to go and help someone because he knew the danger. Like, when you hear someone screaming, there's only, you know, a very, very limited number of things that that can be.
Yeah.
Good chance that it's something that you don't want to paddle towards. So the fact that he did that is very lucky.
And courageous.
And courageous as well. So that kind of, that saves him from being, you know, the unreliable friend that I paint him as. I was lucky that his partner, Aggie, was on the beach that afternoon.
Yeah.
This is the first time I'd ever seen her watching him surf. And she says there's no real explanation as to why she was down on the beach that afternoon. Mm. But I'm lucky that she was, because she's an intensive care nurse and she was the one who called the ambulance and coordinated the rescue effort. Mm. I was lucky that, and everyone always says, like, of course, there's always a nurse there. And I'm like, yeah, there's always a nurse there. And I take it one step further, because there were two nurses there on the beach. Another man named John, who happened to be walking along the beach. Again, he has no explanation as to why he was there that afternoon, but he was the person who got to me first with Joel and applied all the tourniquets, stopped the bleeding. And him, along with Joel, along with where the shark bit me, along with Aggie, along with all these small bits of luck, are what saved my life. And I always say, you know, when I open up with sharing my story, like say if I'm speaking, I always open up with the fact that I shouldn't be here.
Yeah, wow.
And it is a very existential thing to kind of go through. Like, numerically, as I said, I'm probably one of the most unlucky people that anyone is likely to meet in their life. And why I'm here is a bit of a mystery to me. But I'm glad that I am, because the ways, if any of those tiny bits of luck went in the other direction, there's a very, very good chance I'm not here sharing this story. And that is something that motivates me to actually get out there and share it in the first place. So that the purpose of talking about the luck, I think, is something that helps me highlight the, you know, the severity of what it could have been.
Yeah.
But also the flip side of that is the gratitude in being able to make it out the other side of it alive somehow with this story to share. And that's something that kind of drives me to want to share it as often as I can to as many people as possible, because it can make a difference.
I think it will make a huge difference. And firstly, thank you for taking the time to share it. I'd like to just talk about the slowing down part for a second, if we can. I've spoken to lots of people who have been in motor vehicle accidents and other sorts of, you know, traumatic events, and I've been in one or two of my own, nothing as significant as yours, just to be clear. That slowing down of time is something that a lot of people talk about during the accident or the event itself. And I'm just curious to ask if you've got any reasonable explanation, because I have none, by the way. I'm drawing a blank for my own. So I'm hoping you might have some wisdom to share about why that is and how it happens, because a lot of people have shared that thought process when they've been through something traumatic. And I'm just curious to understand what purpose you think that serves in our human reaction.
Yeah, I have done a little bit of reading on this and have looked into it a bit. And what it actually, in my understanding, links to is that fight, flight, or freeze response.
Yeah.
So what the slowing down of time is the freeze response basically kicking into action. So I think a lot of people misconstrue what freeze is. They think freeze is giving up or succumbing to the situation, and it's kind of like the final choice that you make. But in reality, freeze is just fight or flight on hold whilst you gather the information to make the best decision that you can.
Yeah.
So that is why I think a lot of people can really take in all those things, because their brain is processing things at an incredible rate to try and figure out what's around them, what's happening, what are their options, what can they do? And then they can be able to choose what's best out of fight or flight. And the way I kind of look at it is kind of like a bit of a cascade. So you start off with the freeze, and you can see it in my story. So I go from freeze, and then there's that realization of, shit, you're being attacked by a shark. Like, what does everyone say to do there? Like, poke it in the eyes or punch it, right? Everyone's always heard of those things. And I try that, and the punching thing doesn't work, because I'm not sure if you've tried to punch through water.
Oh, it's like there's no power to it, right?
Exactly. And I try it and it doesn't work. And that kind of, I go through that process and I freeze again. And then it's, okay, well, what's left? And really I only have the one left to try, which is just flight, which explains pulling away from the shark and trying to get out of there. Now, it's not a perfect system as far as how that works, because everyone's situation is going to be a little bit different. But from my understanding, that ability to slow things down, to assess what is happening in front of you, and to act as a bit of a placeholder while you figure out what's the best action to do based on instinct is probably the best explanation that I have for time slowing down. And it makes sense, because everyone does have that response.
Mm.
And it's one that is very much related to these events where, you know, they are, whether it be something like mine, which is like a traumatic event, something like a car accident where, you know, it's probably going to be slowing things down so you can figure out if you can steer or brake or do any of these things here. But I think it just comes from that deep instinctual behavior that we have as human beings, which we developed so long ago that, you know, we don't really have heaps of explanation for it other than knowing what happens when we go through it, because you can't map those things out beforehand.
No.
You can't decide what you're going to do. It just happens. And I think it's also a tick in the box of instinct and maybe trusting your gut a little bit more often than not, because it is designed to keep you alive. It's designed to get the best out of every situation for you. And I don't know if that relates or not, but it's something that I try and reflect on a little bit.
I think it does. And the other thing I think that comes out of that is, and I hope no one listening to this goes through a shark attack or something traumatic, right? But I think it does kind of lend itself to the idea of slowing down, taking some time to assess your options before you make decisions in life, particularly major decisions. You're on the board, you feel... So when you got knocked off the board, had the shark bitten you by that stage, or did it come? Did it knock you off first and then bite you?
Yes. Yeah. So it felt like a best way to describe it. Like I didn't play much footy growing up, but the couple of hits that I took, it's like a rugby tackle, right?
Yeah.
And then it swims around the other side and bites me on the leg.
Got it. I didn't play much footy either, because I'm just not built for footy, mate. I was, you know, back in the day, 50 kgs ringing wet. But I wanted to ask you about that moment when your worst fears are being realized. And I don't know if you're able to remember what you were thinking or feeling as you look down and the shark's got you, right? And again, I know nothing about sharks. I actually have a bit of a fear of sharks, which is one of the reasons why I've never been keen to embrace surfing, to be absolutely honest, apart from a complete lack of coordination. But that's a whole nother challenge. When you're steering, like, because sometimes our fears are in our imagination, right? But then when it manifests and it happens and you're going, holy shit, what were you thinking? What were you feeling? Or were you thinking or feeling anything at all?
There was nothing conscious that I was thinking in like in the moment when it happened. There's just this response where, again, you're kind of in that moment where it's all those things that I just described. But there's also this alternate thing that I've found it really difficult to explain, which happens at the same time, which is almost like you're zooming out of the situation and you're kind of looking down at it in this weird existential sort of way. And I know that doesn't describe much about the situation, but it's kind of like there's these two things going on. Mm. And I don't know if that's just kind of separation from what is happening there, or maybe it's just something that comes with hindsight as you're looking back at the experience. But I always liken it to, again, I'm going to make it sound like I've played a lot of footy, but I played one day of AFL in my life, and it was the day I broke my collarbone. And I still remember this day because it was this big gala day. There's like 15 different schools there, so lots of kids. This guy lands on me. I break my collarbone. I'm laying there in pain, and it felt like the entire, like every single person there was surrounded around me because this person's been injured. And it kind of felt like that, except I was the crowd that was around this incident that's happening. So there's this weird feeling of looking at it from the outside whilst you're still in it at the same time. And I think relating that to fears, I think we can work ourselves up so much over what the fear is, when it might happen, like what it's going to look like, what it's going to feel like. But I think the reality is it's always going to be so different to that, whether it's not as bad as what you think it's going to be, yeah, or potentially a lot worse.
Yeah.
I think if I can actually look back and see if I had any coherent thoughts that I could reflect on, there's probably two. And I think they both come from me having that fear of being attacked by a shark as well, because I think as a surfer, it is always going to be a fear that you have. Yeah. People deal with it in different ways. And I'm not sure if you'd call it a fear or just the reality of surfing. You're going into their environment. It's just a risk that you have to take on. And the two things that I speak of, the first one that I could probably recount was the feeling of, I can't believe it's happened here, of all places.
Oh, wow. Okay. In your own backyard kind of thing.
Yeah, because I've spent a lot of time surfing all over Australia, all over the world, and I've surfed a lot of places which would be considered far, like sharkier. places like South Australia, for example,
yep,
where, you know, you're out there and it just feels different when you're in the water because it's got this thing attached to it where you know it's reported that there's more sharks down there.
Yep.
So I think that was one of them, being like, I can't believe it's happened here. And then the other one that I would think would be actually this small reflection on Bethany Hamilton's story. So I'm not sure if you know of Bethany Hamilton, but she is a couple of years older than me, but she was attacked by a shark when she was a lot younger. She had her arm bitten off.
Okay.
She has a movie. She's got a book. She's got a documentary as well. But in her movie, I remember her saying that one of the things that kept her alive was she didn't look down at it because she didn't want to panic. She wanted more blood than she was supposed to. And that was something that just stuck with me for some reason. And in a weird way, I think I was strangely prepared to be attacked by a shark because I had that in the back of my mind as maybe that's a response. But again, it's not something that I made a conscious decision to not do until later on when I'm on the beach, I'm removed from that danger and you have a little bit more cognition about what's going on in the situation. But the fears, I think, they are as much preparation for worst case scenario as like unnecessary worrying and anxiety about the worst case scenario as well. I think those fears for some people can be so debilitating because it will actually cause them not to do things. But then on the other hand, they can help you prepare for, you know, what it might feel like if you do go through this worst case scenario. And I always try and weigh that up when I'm, you know, trying to do things for myself, or, you know, if someone else is asking me about making a decision or doing something big in their life, and there's always that fear attached to it. I view that not as a weakness at all, because I think it shows that we are thinking about the situation as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the best way to counteract fears is with as much logic as possible.
Yep.
That's not always, you know, the easiest thing in the world to do. But no. If you were to tell me that sharks are one of your greatest fears, which they are for a lot of people, yeah, it's the two of the top three is sharks and public speaking. Now, I don't mean to tick off two.
Exactly. What's the number three, just so we can tick that off for you as well? While we're
I don't know what the third one is, but the top two is something. Well, there's something I used to cover quite a lot when I was talking to people, and they were just the two that came up most often.
Yeah.
So calling him part of the top three just kind of came commonplace. But when it comes to that fear, and what has helped me get back in the water afterwards has been education.
Yeah. Okay.
So knowing things like the odds of being attacked by a shark, knowing things like shark behavior, mm-hmm. when or where they may be more likely to be hunting than others, what conditions they may be hunting in, whether that be water temperature, water quality, what food sources are available. So there's different ways you can try your best to counter that fear with logic.
Yep.
I don't think it's ever going to 100% get rid of it though. Like, it's still always going to be there.
Well, I mean, I think that's part of being human, isn't it? I mean, yes. Having that logical explanation, as you say, knowing the habitat, knowing the food sources, knowing the water temperatures and so on. Absolutely. I think it comes down to a game of probability when you're doing those sorts of things. The probability of an attack is much lower at certain times in certain environments than in others. And I think that really helps. You're on the beach, right? You've got your friends there, you've got your bystanders there, you've got people there looking out for you. And as you say, lots of luck that led to that. So were you airlifted to Sydney? Were you off to Wollongong? Where did you go for surgery?
So I was airlifted to St. George Hospital in Sydney.
Yep.
That was a bit of a process in itself.
Okay.
Just getting, because I was on the beach and helicopters can't land on the beach. So it was kind of like these different stages that we had to go through to get in the helicopter. So go from having just that informal first aid on the beach, which is those leg ropes and the wetsuits tied around me. They bring some paramedics down, they apply their tourniquets, take the leg ropes and stuff off. And then it's kind of a bit of a waiting game for the helicopter. But whilst we're waiting, they're like, okay, we need to get you up into the car park because the helicopter can't land on the beach because of all the sand. So they have to figure out a way to get me up off the beach, take me into the ambulance, and then transport me up into the car park, because the way the beach is configured, it's not as easy as it looks, and you have to cross this small creek. And
yeah, you got to go under the bridge too, don't you?
Yeah, so there's we didn't have to go under the bridge because it happened basically right in front of that bridge.
Ah, okay, got it.
So they just go straight up into the car park, and that's when the helicopter took me off to St. George Hospital. But that's, again, another bit of luck, because they had to send two helicopters to get me. The first one went to Bondi Beach.
There was a mutation.
Sent one to Bondi, realized there was nothing happening at Bondi Beach, radioed back, sent a second one to pick me up. Again, just another small bit of luck that who knows how things would have turned out if, luckily that second one got to me on time and had the blood on board, and I needed two transfusions just on the way to hospital. But
wow.
I was completely conscious right up until the moment I got in the helicopter.
Then you lost consciousness.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I presume once you've lost consciousness, you then wake up presumably in hospital post-surgery. Is that what happened after that?
I didn't regain consciousness until the next day.
Yeah.
So the painkillers that they actually gave me while I was in the helicopter gave me some quite lucid dreams, and I actually dreamt that I went through my entire recovery, which was a strange, strange experience, and something that is, I'm not sure if it's something you can look at through like a spiritual lens or just like a coincidence or what it might be, but like I dreamt waking up in the hospital, getting out of a hospital bed, going through my recovery, and like sort of it's this montage of like going through all these different stages of the recovery, like running again. And then, and at the time I didn't know the details of the injury. Like it's just like injury and getting better. And then it kind of like all comes to this grinding halt when I wake up in hospital again. And at that stage, the day after, I hadn't had the major surgery.
Right.
That happened a couple of days after I was in hospital, but they had taken me in, they'd cleaned a fair bit of the sand out of the wound, and they were just assessing at the time because they didn't know what they could do at that stage. They were trying to see how bad the damage was. They were trying to see, what they would be able to do to save the leg. There was a lot of concerns about that in the beginning.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. So how close were you to losing the leg?
Very close for a couple of different reasons. So where the shark bit me, so I ended up losing 3/4 of my left quad.
Mm.
There was 15 centimeters of exposed bone. The injury is classified as a degloving injury.
Yep.
Which you'll know what that means.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So luckily the shark didn't bite into the bone, but the injury goes over both sides of it. So if it had broken through that sheath that covers the bone, there's a good chance that gets infected and it has to get amputated. They weren't sure if they were going to be able to cover that up or what was going to be available. So they cleaned it out the first time, assessed it, tried to see what options there were. And then 2 days later, they cleaned it out again. They said they've never seen so much sand in the wound. And this is kind of like the second risk of amputation. They're like, surely there's going to be some sort of infection here, and whatever we do could just be completely undone by what happens underneath. So they clean it out as much as they can. And then at this stage, 3 days into being in hospital, they come to me and they say, hey, we think we might know what to do to fix this whole situation. It's quite experimental. As far as we can tell, it's only been done once before. But what they ended up doing was they do what's called a free flap muscle transplant, where they took my left lat muscle from my back, so the entire lat muscle, and transplant that into the leg, just to cover the bone. So they were kind of stuck as to what muscles they could use. The quad's obviously a very, very large muscle, and there wasn't anything else they could really take or transplant, despite the fact that they wouldn't usually take a lat muscle from a surfer, a swimmer, or a rock climber, because you need that for the pulling motion or the paddling motion in my case. But they just didn't have any other options. So despite my dad trying to donate his quads to me and mum trying to ask if they could grow it in a petri dish, they were like, no, this is all we can do. So they do this operation on the 3rd of April. So the attack was the 30th of March, and I had this operation on the 3rd of April, which is also coincidentally my birthday. So pretty good birthday present to have, I must say.
Yeah, get to keep my leg.
Yeah, exactly. So they transplant the muscle, they connect a blood supply to keep the muscle alive. They connect a nerve, which they say at the time, like, we don't know if this is going to work. It's kind of, we're doing it just in case. And then they do skin grafts. So they take skin from my calf, my hamstring, and then up on my hip and kind of patch it all together. And then it's just a waiting game. It's kind of just, it's all about wound management and wound healing for the next 5 weeks that I was in hospital, which is a very tedious time for me. I haven't spent a whole heap of time in hospital, but for me, that was a lot of waiting around and a lot of uncertainty kind of playing on my mind as far as what was to come next. Because at that stage, after the operation, the doctors were sort of looking at it and weighing it up, and they go to give you the prognosis and they say, look, losing 3/4 of the quad is no joke. You need it for a lot of different actions and movements in life, and walking is one of them. So the ability for you to walk unaided is probably not going to happen. They thought, best case scenario, I was going to have a device on my knee that would essentially straighten it out and perform the function of the quad.
Yeah.
But on the backside of that, there's implications in, you know, living an active lifestyle, running. But the number one thing that they tell me relating to surfing is that, like, you'll never surf again. Like, the complexities you're going to have in walking and running is going to be enough of a challenge. Something like surfing, where there's so many different movements, different contractions, the way in which your body contorts, they're like, it's just, don't even think about it because it's way too complicated. And that's something that obviously plays on my mind for the next 5 weeks, is just the ups and downs of trying to picture what life is going to be like, you know, not only with the challenges that I'm going to have walking and living some sort of normal life, but without surfing again. Like, that for me was so heartbreaking in the moment.
So there's obviously the physical recovery, but the mental recovery is massive too, right? Now, clearly we know you've got your leg, we know you can walk unaided, and we know you've been able to get on a board, right? So that's a big kind of jump from never going to surf again, probably won't be able to walk unaided, to living what seems to be, at least from the outside looking at, a pretty active lifestyle. I'm curious to ask about both the physical and the mental recovery, because, again, you know, it sounds very trite to say this out loud, and I don't mean it in any way to sound trite, but there's that expression, it's not what happens to you, it's how you deal with it, right? And other people may not have dealt with it the same way that you've dealt with it. So what I'm trying to ask is, where did that inner strength come from? Because I imagine the rehab was hard. I imagine there was pain, there was discomfort, there were setbacks. How did you find the physical and mental strength to push through?
Yeah, I think it's a good point, kind of highlighting both of those journeys, the physical recovery and the mental recovery, because they are two separate things, but they're related. Mm. Everything that I've been able to achieve physically would not have happened if I didn't take control of the mental side of things. And for me, it's not something that I was able to do alone. I was lucky that I had a lot of great support around me that kind of helped me work through that process of not only dealing with the trauma to begin with, and that's the support that I had from people like my friends and my family and my community, all the people around me, which were amazing just to kind of let me know that they were there.
Yeah.
Then there's other people which play such a significant part in the recovery, which are people like my physiotherapist. And a physio is obviously going to play a very big part and a big role in a recovery because they're connected to it. But there's some words that I get from my physiotherapist back when I'm still laying in a hospital bed, right after I actually come out of that surgery, where he sends me a message wishing me well, heard that I'd had the operation. It's been a big day. And he actually just offers his help and support because he wants to see me get better. But he has some words of advice in relation to goal setting that really pushes me along and gets me to look at things a lot differently, and I guess is the counter to everything that the doctors were telling me. Mm. And he says, regardless of the prognosis, you've got a long road ahead of you. People fail not from aiming too high and missing, but from aiming too low and hitting. Ooh. Look ahead with determination and set lofty goals. So that's the response I love to get from that quote.
Right? Oh, man. God, that brings a tear to your eye.
If there's ever anything someone needs to hear in that position, after you've just been, you know, gone through the trauma itself, but then have been told by doctors that this is what to expect. Yeah. Like, it goes to show that sometimes those small messages that you can send someone, and obviously this is connected to the fact that he actually wanted to help me with the rehab.
Yeah, of course.
But just the ability to try and look at the situation a little bit differently was something that I needed, because I think the other path and the other side of that is to spiral downwards, knowing that, you know, your life's going to be different. What's it going to look like without all of these things that you love, and kind of being constrained by all of the things that the doctors had told you? And I think it's easy to be caught in that mindset because it's kind of natural as humans. Yeah. it's always that emotional response. But then having people like that to help level you back out is incredibly important. And Scott, my physiotherapist, is one person where I talk about that support being there to help me through it. And he was such a big part of that because he helped me set those goals and to be ambitious and to set my sights higher than, you know, just hobbling around the house. That he was the person that helped me set the goals of getting back in the water and surfing again and everything that comes after that. Because once someone has that confidence in you, they believe in you and they back you as well. As soon as you see that in action and you start to get some results with that sort of mindset and that approach,
yeah,
what comes next after that is incredible, because it's just building on one thing after another. Like, once you see one thing is possible, it's always just, well, what next? And then what next after that? And then what next after that? So it goes from like regaining independence to regaining livelihood, you know, getting back to work and these basic ways of life. And then eventually 5 months after, getting back in the water and surfing. But it doesn't end there. It's all about, you know, what can we do after that? How much can I push my surfing? What other things can I take on? And it's always been for me, and I'm, you know, as you say, from the outside, it looks like I'm living quite an active lifestyle. And a big part of that is still because of that message that Scott sent me when I was in hospital. It's the most important thing that I've received in my life.
That's a gift right there from Scott. That's a massive gift. It's really the gift of life in many senses. Do you think the fact that you were a competitive surfer prior to the incident, and being a competitive surfer means you're probably pretty mentally strong, you're used to competing, you're dealing with adversity, setbacks, etc. How much of a role do you think that state of being before the accident had on your recovery post-accident?
I think it helps in two ways. I was very driven as a surfer because it's something that I was very passionate about. And I think being taught that, you know, if you have something that you care a lot about and you want to try to achieve it, then you're going to do whatever you can to make it happen. I think that's part of it. But I think the other side of surfing in particular that helped me a lot is surfing teaches you to lose. Surfing, especially competitive surfing.
Yes.
And my dad used to always say surfing's such a brutal sport because after 20 minutes, half of the field goes home. So, and there's only one winner at the end of the day. So, you know, if you've got 64 different surfers in the field, 63 of you are losers. And yeah. My surfing really came along later in life. I didn't have a successful junior career. It's something that came on when I was like sort of 20 to 22 years old.
Yeah.
So I spent a lot of time losing, and I think the ability to know how to bounce back from that and to want to keep pushing forward despite, you know, there's always that negative feedback of losing and not being as good as the person next to you, I think was something that probably helped me with the tenacity that you need to get up every single day and to keep pushing ahead. And I think that does really relate to what I said before. Like if it's something that you care enough about,
yeah,
that means a lot to you, and you kind of lead into different conversations about purpose and greater, wider goal setting methods. But the ability to have these things in life that you truly care about is one thing, but then knowing you're going to have setbacks along the way is, you know, it's part of it.
It's really interesting. I've got a daughter who's a competitive gymnast, and anyone listening to the podcast will know I talk about that a bit. And yeah, in terms of setbacks and all those things, it's the same sort of thing. Like one false move in an apparatus, you know, the whole meet's kind of done. And so it's really high pressure and not much margin for error. And as she says herself, is, you know, learning to lose is as important as learning to win.
Yeah.
And the sports psych that she sees is kind of really helping her cope with setbacks, because I think if you can deal with a setback in life, and of course I wouldn't call your event a setback. It's obviously a setback, but it's way more than a setback. But learning to deal with setbacks in life is, I think, a really good predictor for success. The people that I've seen achieve wonderful things in their lives in all endeavors have all had to deal with some sort of setback. And so getting okay with that is good. You've been working with Scott, the physio. He sent you this incredible message. You've set these mini goals, and obviously each goal is a step up from the previous one. I want to talk about getting back in the water. How was that?
I got asked this question yesterday, and it's something that I've thought about, but the way to answer it is kind of different now to what I used to, because I used to say, like, you know, I'd put so much time and effort into it up until that point that I'd just jump in. But the reality is there's still the doubts that you have there. Mm. And those doubts are kind of seeded in what you think of yourself. But more importantly for me, the doubts kind of came from comparing myself to the surf that I was before. And these are all things that in the moment I was confronted with, because I didn't see the day that I was allowed to go surfing coming from a long way out. Like, it actually caught me by surprise. It happened, as I said, 5 months into this recovery journey.
Yep.
And at that stage, I had kind of reached this place where things were starting to plateau a little bit. And, you know, I'm working harder and harder in the gym trying to get better, but the gains just get smaller. And when that happens, there's always this inevitable point where you start to question what's possible and if you're going to be able to reach that final destination. And I remember walking into physio that day, and I was doing my stretches, and Scott walks over, and I think he knows that we're kind of getting to this point. And he just simply says, like, oh, see if you can stand up as if you're on a surfboard. And I try it the first time and do a pretty average job at it. Mm. He says, maybe give it another go. And I do a little bit better the second time. But when I wasn't prepared at all for him to then say, I think you should go for a surf, because like there's obviously the excitement that comes from that, and the fact that it comes out of nowhere is amazing. But then I was really kind of flooded by those doubts. And what I do next is I call my friend Nick for two reasons. One, because he said, when you can go for a surf, let me know. But the second reason is actually because I felt like I wanted to talk to someone about these doubts.
Mm.
And that's something I'd learned quite a lot through my journey, is when you are going through the doubts or those tough days, that to just engage the support that's around you, because getting a different perspective on it, that was very, very helpful for me throughout the recovery. So I called Nick mainly with the idea of talking to him about these doubts that I had. And I made the mistake of opening up the conversation with, Scott said I can go for a surf. That's all that Nick wanted to hear. And he was just pumped. He was like, oh, that's so good. I'll get a surfboard. I'll come for you. We'll go. And he just hung up. And so it's kind of like I had these doubts, but also I was kind of just being thrown in the deep end. And before I knew it, Nick was there picking me up, and we were on our way to the beach. And we did get time to talk about those doubts in the car on the way down. But sure. It's something where I think, because it came out of nowhere, I didn't have time to overthink it before I got in the water. Like, I still thought it would be months, maybe even years before I could surf again at the time. Like, I didn't really know what how I was supposed to be feeling to get back in the water. And I think it goes to show, you know, these breakthroughs, they might not happen at the time that you expect a lot of the times. Sometimes they might happen early, sometimes they might happen late, but it just kind of, for me, reinforces the fact that you still show up every day and you do the work, regardless of where the end point is meant to be. And then having the right support around you whenever you do get to that ultimate point is very important. And I think that first surf kind of came out of nowhere. I was more worried about those doubts of, well, what's surfing going to look like for me? I'm obviously not going to be surfing the same as I was the day of the attack. And they, for me, were the bigger things that I had to deal with. I think a lot of people would expect that dealing with the fear of sharks would be the bigger thing that you have to kind of go through.
Yeah, I would have assumed.
Yeah, but that didn't come till a little bit later, because I think there was just so much excitement about getting back in the water that was important for me. And then after that, I started surfing a little bit more, just trying to get in the water. And you'd have those inevitable points where you'd maybe be sitting out there by yourself and you find yourself looking around and questioning it. And from there, I was like, if this is going to be a part of me surfing, I'm just going to have to learn about it. I'm going to have to educate and be comfortable.
Yeah.
And I think that's where, when I learned more about sharks and all those things we spoke about before, I was able to then feel more comfortable with the choice that I had made to go in the water. And then sometimes I would look at it and say, you know what, maybe it's a little bit late in the day. I'm okay going and doing something else.
Yeah.
And that's something that the surfer before wouldn't have done. I would have kind of, you know, as a young male, you're probably going to be like, no, that's fine. Just push through it. Like, yeah, you'll be fine. And I think it's a point of growth for me where I'm okay to look at the conditions and make a decision and be okay with that decision myself to weigh it up and say, maybe not today, maybe tomorrow.
Yeah. You've had your greatest fear. Like, you've actually confronted it. You've lived it, right? And it was difficult. Well, it was more than difficult. It was bloody awful, right? I don't want to put words into your mouth. What strength do you take from the fact that you've actually seen off your biggest fear and survived your biggest fear? How do you live now compared to how you lived before?
Well, there's two sides of things. I think a lot of people would go through that and say, like, the biggest fear should still be there. And it still kind of is. I always joke with people about, you know, the odds of being attacked by a shark are this and the odds of being attacked twice. Like, you know, you'd hope it doesn't happen again. It's never zero, though.
No.
I think the biggest way it's changed my life is looking at how quickly things can change.
Mm.
And I think that's, you know, probably the cliche, obvious takeaway that you would have from it, which is that life is short and that you need to live every day to the fullest. But I think the way that that has changed the way I live my life is incredibly important. And the reason I say that is because I think the way I actually operate now is very much based on knowing how short life is, wanting to do as much as I can with the time that I have.
Mm.
And again, I know that sounds like a very straightforward thing to say, but if I was to get you to set a goal today, knowing that you have 40 years ahead of you, as opposed to getting you to set a goal today with 3 or 6 months ahead of you, I can tell you those goals are going to be very, very different.
Mm.
And I think taking that approach of saying, well, if life can change as quickly as what I know it can change, then why not just go for those things that are probably more ambitious? And this goes back to the importance of what Scott taught me in the first place and why setting goals like that is really important. But I think it's something that you don't want to look back at the end of the day and say, maybe I had a little bit more to give. Maybe I had some things that I left on the table, because, again, I delve all the way into all the cliches here. But
go for it, mate. Cliche away. I love it.
My favorite quote is that we all have two lives, and our second begins that when we realize we only have one.
Yeah.
And I think you can learn that in a number of different ways, but the sooner you realize it, the sooner you can actually start living. And I think that is such a powerful takeaway for me, which I think has helped me really build a life around the fact that I'm very grateful, very lucky to be alive, and I want to make the most of it. And I think that is something that will always drive me to want to share that story as well, because I know the impact that that can have on other people. And I think the best way to explain it is I look at the day I was attacked by a shark, and this kind of goes back into the fear side of thing. It would be easy to look at it as a negative, terrible day, which it was at the time, but I look back at it and say it was the best day of my life. And the reason I say it is because it gave me so much more than it took away. So if I was still living the same life, like, maybe I would still be surfing, maybe I'd still be trying to achieve that dream of becoming a professional surfer. Maybe it would have happened. Chances are, if I look at things logically, I'd still probably be working in the surf shop, maybe still doing my own surf school things. And whilst you can make someone's day selling them a surfboard they really, really love, you're probably not going to change their life.
Yeah.
And I kind of live by the fact that if I can share my story as much as possible and it helps just one person, then it's all worth it. And I know I've helped more than one person already, but there's certain people that I've come across where it makes so much sense why I look at that as the best day of my life. And I think it's worth sharing a story about a lady who messaged me shortly after my film came out. So the film came out on the 9th of March this year.
Yep.
Attacking Life. So it came out on the 9th. And then on the 10th, so the day after, I got a message from this lady who I had no connection to, didn't know who she was, no mutual friends or anything like that. And she messaged me and she said, I just came across your film on Stan and I watched it yesterday and it sat with me so much that I watched it two more times today. So she watched it three times in 2 days. And then she said, it's actually inspired me to book in and make a change because I had a stroke 3 years ago and I want to learn to walk again. So she actually booked in after watching the film to try and make a positive change in her life. And that for me is what it's all about. Like I wouldn't have been able to make that impact in a previous life. And it's something I go to gratitude a lot and say, I'm very grateful that that's something that I've been able to do. And that story and that person will sit with me for a very long time.
Look, having watched the shorts of the film, it is really remarkable. I do have a question about the film. Is that like the surfing on there? That's you surfing, right?
Yep, all of it.
Well, I'll tell you what, if that's the post-recovery surfing, it's pretty awesome, mate. So I don't know what you're like beforehand, but I look at that and go, man, that's pretty cool. So you still got it by the look of it, mate.
Thank you.
Brett, I wanted to just wrap up our conversation with, I guess, a final thought. You did mention that you look back on that day, the 30th of March, 2016, as something to be grateful for you. And at the beginning, you spoke about forks in the road. Where do you see life taking you now? Obviously, you're sharing your story, you're doing movies, you're doing all those other things. What's the big gift that it's given you? I know you said there's gratitude and your life is different and it's given you so much more than it's taken. Is the gift really to be able to help and inspire other people, which I think is incredibly noble and I think that's phenomenal. I can see you doing that in so many ways. But I'm curious to understand what's next for you.
It's a good question because it helps me look at things on a few different levels. Like, yes, for me, one part of life is always, you know, I am driven now very purpose-based on using this story of mine to try and help other people. And whether that be through speaking, podcasts or films, like I think that's something that has been such a big shift in who I am as a person. But I also have seen, well, this is more of a personal, again, a slight doubt of mine, of knowing that there's probably only a certain amount of time that I can share the story for. Like, I don't know if that's the case or not, but I've always felt like there's probably a time limit before I'm, you know, some salty old guy who's telling a story about when he got attacked by a shark when he was 22. And I don't know if it'll hold the same weight then. It'll still be the story that it is. But I think for me, the importance then becomes how can I help other people have the same impact that I'm able to have right now. So that was actually the purpose for making the film and producing it with Sam and creating our own production company under that, is to create a bit of a runway where we can do more projects like that in the future. Because as you know, you don't have to look far for an incredible story. There's so many people out there that have something to share, who can inspire, who can change someone's life. And if I can help other people do that on the back of what I'm already doing now, and you know, I can look back when I am that salty old guy, I think I can be a very happy salty old guy.
I think that's a really wonderful endeavor. I think, you know, creating that space for people to share and tell their stories so that they help other people is terrific. And I didn't realize you'd had a production company set up as well. So that's phenomenal. Good on you. Wow. Storytelling. Really quickly, I went to Disney a little while ago and we took a group of clients there. And out of the whole thing, the biggest theme that came away was the power of story And the power of story to uplift, the power of story to inspire, the power of story to help people through whatever they're going through. And your story is as compelling, inspiring as anything I've ever heard in my life, Brett. And thank you so much for sharing it with us. I wouldn't have wished that event upon you, but I'm really pleased you've turned something so traumatic into something so wonderful. And mate, when you're a crusty old salty sea dog, mate, I think you'll be able to look back on your life with immense pride, mate. So thank you.
Thank you. Well, I hope so. That's the plan. We'll see how we go.
Yeah, a few years before you're crusty and old, just going to point that out. But anyway, you got to get to my age before you're crusty and old, mate.
Trying to look at.
It's good stuff. All right, mate. Listen, I really appreciate you taking the time to come and talk to us here on the podcast. And please continue that storytelling, because I think it's a really important story. And if I may be so bold, wherever Scott is, mate, give him a high five for me, mate, because that is a, you know, that quote he gave you, that's a real, you know, point to the heart, that one, mate.
Definitely. And next time you're in Kiama, we might have to take you out for a little surf lesson. We'll see.
All right, mate. All right. We'll go in that little creek in front of Bombo Beach. How's that?
Perfect.
All right. I'll take you up on that. Hey, mate, you're a good man, Brett. So take good care, and look forward to talking to you in Kiama, mate.
Yeah, thank you.
Cheers, mate.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast. For more episodes, go to drjessegreen.com/savvydentist. And to discover how to build a high-performance dental practice, visit drjessegreen.com and download the free report.